Good to be with you, dear brethren. I appreciate the invitation, the opportunity of the Columbus Brethren, Columbus, Ohio Brethren, to speak to you and consider some things that are from experience. Now, I'm not the voice of experience. That was Brother Russell. I'm a voice of experience, just by a fact of years. But as we've sung, to try and eliminate some of the doubts and fears that could beset us. And that's why the topic, Important Lessons from the Past. This was partially inspired by a letter and some literature from Sister Hirsch. She's about 100 years old and for decades has been a faithful soldier of the cross. Along with her letter about some information, she sent us a booklet that maybe a lot of you haven't read. I was not aware of it. And the title is Light After Darkness. I'll refer to that later. And it covers a period directly following the society's takeover by one J.F. Rutherford. It doesn't seem possible that after 40 years of guidance by Brother Russell, that one could come in and in so short a time disrupt the whole organization. Because, as I will say later, of his tactics, and they were dictatorial. For many years, the late Brother Bob Chastain and I discussed these things. And having lived through some of the latter influences of that organization, and we agreed, because you'll remember Brother Bob Chastain was not one for compromise. And he always did it in a loving way, a helpful way. And we agreed that the truth is not isolated property, but common property. I think this should be kept in mind. The truth is common property. And it is inadvisable for anyone to take the bit in his mouth and start off in his own direction, other than what that faithful and wise servant has indicated very clearly. We don't like things that are said to be, well, this is a new thought. As Bob Chastain would say, I don't have anything new. I just want to repeat and recall the old, old story that's ever new, like an evergreen. And Brother Russell says in the manna for August the 20th, that the apostles' method is worthy of imitation. All wise people distrust novelty and incline to see that whatever is valuable has long been. Do we realize what he's saying here? But we, like the apostles, should endeavor to show that the true gospel is not a new theology, but the old theology. Not a new gospel, but the old gospel. And this is in direct opposition to what the world constantly craves. Something new. Something sensational. Something dramatic. One respected historian said, we learn from history that we learn nothing from history. And this is sad. And too often, this is the case even among Bible students. I'm speaking of Bible student history. 60 years ago, on October the 31st, our dear pastor finished his course in death, a course that brought untold blessings to thousands, including us, through a knowledge of the glorious harvest truth. But the cost to him personally was very high. It cost him his total fortune. It cost him all his mental and physical powers. And finally, it cost him his good name, as well as his life and reputation. Certainly it cost him his former friends and that of his wife, Mrs. Russell. Now, all of this the Lord required at his hand to complete Brother Russell's sacrifice. And I believe it will cost every one of us aspiring to a place in the little flock the same high price. That is our all, which we have coveted to do. A covenant by sacrifice. Recently we heard a brother attempt to harmonize with the chart his interpretation of the harvest, the glorification of the church, the great company's tribulation, and the destruction of Babylon. I made me a little sick at heart to hear such confusion on matters so clearly taught in volumes 3 and 4, those classics. And for example, his thought on the great company's tribulation was a contradiction of tabernacle shadows. So right off, it's wrong. Now, as a teacher, he should have been aware of this. Doesn't agree with tabernacle shadows, it's error. Now, it was bad enough that the brother gave his talk a first time to brethren new in the truth. But now he has repeated it in various places. We hope some have challenged him for his own sake as well as others, because teaching error to God's little ones carries a great responsibility. The late historian Arnold Toynbee noted that our society can no longer be aroused to righteous indignation. You know, they're liberal and free and understanding. And so, because of this lack of judgment, of discernment, to some extent, this is also true of Bible students. Unless we really love the principles of righteousness and truth and hate iniquity, that is error, with an equal intensity, we will not be established firmly in the truth. Now, how much do we really love the truth? Do we love it enough to put it first and above everything else? Our Lord enumerated the things, you know, if you love those, any of those things more than me, you cannot be my disciple. Do we love it more than being a teacher and getting the acclaim of our followers? To be voted in by the ecclesia? If we find ourselves exerting too much influence over others, could we take the initiative to break this dependence? Now, these are questions all teachers, that is elders, will need to examine and find answers for themselves. Are we receiving the love and gratitude from little ones and new ones in the truth that really belongs to the Lord's servant? And point to him as the seventh and last messenger? Are we accusing brethren of following a dead man? That may seem a harsh question, but it has been said. From years of experience, several decades, I am aware that changes can come subtly and suddenly. So while I still have a voice to raise, I want to register my righteous indignation against the errors being taught and received by some of the brethren today. 6 years ago, just 6 years ago, we were rejoicing in our newfound freedom from the bondage of error. We were rejoicing in the love and fellowship of brethren who were willing to stand up and be counted. We were rejoicing also in our privileges of service and in the zeal for the truth we had recovered or rediscovered. Ways and means for a wider witness were being planned and initiated. Even the republication of studies in the scriptures was undertaken. Thank the Lord. The radio and TV witness of the glorious truth was begun and expanded. And numerous other services to the brethren were established. Now, just 6 years later, a rift between the brethren is widening. Needlessly, when the dawn teaching started to change the harvest message, I personally used all my influence for a number of years to help brethren see the errors and to encourage them to stand for the truth and make a witness thereof. Now I hear the charges that we, because of that, do not have the truth, and the implications are that such are going into the great company. Now, there's nothing new about judging our brethren. This has gone on for years. Nor is there anything new for brethren in error to manifest it by passing personal judgment on the brethren with whom they disagree. Now, we have two notable examples, and that of J.F. Rutherford and P.S.L. Johnson, and the errors they spawned that produce such an unholy spirit in them are the very same errors some brethren are now unwittingly embracing. Isn't that strange? It's enough to break one's heart. But it comes right back to what the pastor said in November 1916, the year of his death. It's a disgrace to an ecclesia or the brethren in general to support improper leaders. Most everyone in present truth knows something about the trouble at Bethel after Brother Russell's death. But let me recall a few specifics on how the Lord's sheep were scattered. Following Brother Russell's death, the society's affairs were thrown into turmoil almost immediately by an ambitious leader and his two henchmen. The amazing developments which followed would be beyond belief if they were not documented by four of the directors that Brother Russell had appointed to serve on his board for life. And here again I have Sister Hirsch's loving letter and the article Light After Darkness. It's about a four-page booklet about the size of the watchtower, edited by the brethren who were pushed out, asked, and if they didn't go, they were forced out of the society. J.F. Rutherford, who was an attorney and one of the seven directors, declared the pastor's last will and testament illegal within a few weeks of the pastor's death. Can you imagine that? Therefore, its terms were not binding on those in charge of the society's affairs. If you haven't read this will, it is given in its entirety on reprint page 5999. Now, according to its terms, the society was not to have another head, but was to be governed by the board of directors, plural. However, being assured beforehand that he would be elected president at the shareholders' meeting in January 1917, Joseph Rutherford himself drew up some bylaws, sent them by the hand of a committee to that meeting. The bylaws were approved and stipulated that the president should be executive manager in full charge of all the society's affairs, both in foreign lands and America. But these bylaws were really illegal, because the society's charter provided its directors shall have full power to make bylaws and so forth. So Rutherford called the meeting of the directors on his return and urged them to approve his bylaws. And to our amazement, the account states that the directors did just that. Even though they were reluctant to give him this unlimited control, they did so, thinking it would make the transition easier, which was just a lot of wishful thinking. It's evident that these humble-minded directors were no match for this shrewd, selfish, and conniving attorney. He was an orator, all right. He outshouted him. Some years earlier, when Brother Russell donated all his writings to which he held title to the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, the board of directors entered into a solemn covenant promising that his charter would be followed for continuing the work, and that the board he appointed, Brother Russell appointed, would conduct the society's affairs according to his wishes. They do all of that, did they? They promised to do this not only during his life, but also following Brother Russell's death. But one of these directors, J.F. Rutherford, disregarded his part in the covenant entirely. Now, mind you, after being decades with the pastor, a real saint, in a short time, he disregarded Brother Russell's wishes entirely. He violated Brother Russell's will, declaring his charter illegal, and thrust out of office four of his directors, claimed to have been appointed illegally. Now, according to this usurper, Brother Russell was conducting business illegally for all the years of his ministry. Something to think about. All these things and more happened within 9 months of Brother Russell's death. Just 9 months, less than a year. Now, the dictatorial rule that followed forced out of Bethel all who would not fully endorse his teachings. We might ask, why did brethren submit to such tactics? For one thing, most of the brethren across the country were not in a position to know what was going on at Bethel. And in the absence of hard, clear evidence, the incumbent, who always has an advantage, certainly had the benefit of the doubt. Any attempts made by the expelled directors to expose the matter were always cleverly turned back upon them. They were falsely shown to be the enemy, ambitious leaders whom he, Rutherford, had thwarted in their plans to run the society according to Brother Russell's wish and charter. And so this is his leadership, that is Rutherford's, went unchallenged, and with it truth was systematically replaced by error. Smite the shepherd, Zechariah says in 13:7, smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. Now my question is, would any of us follow such a leader? Or anyone like him? Now, none of us would do that knowingly, of course. But if we accept today the same errors that scuttled the harvest way back there, then we have come under his influence, whether we know it or not. Brother Kendall, before he died, said, some of the errors, the same old errors, are dressed up in a new suit. He had to leave the society. The emperor's new clothes. That's what it really is. Now, what can be done about it? The only thing that can be done about differences among free brethren is to get the truth out in the open. In other words, in the truth, there isn't any room for a cover-up of any kind. Now, as to the truth, we cannot insist that everyone accept it, but we can urge brethren to consider the evidence thereto. And we can pray that the Lord will give understanding and judgment to each one of us in the spirit of love, and to be carried out in that spirit, to speak the truth in love. And in my experience, there was never a greater example, regardless of age, than Brother Bob Chastain. Now, most of the brethren promoting these ideas are not aware that they are erroneous interpreters, however conscientious in their beliefs. And this is due to leaders who have misled, because they are the responsible ones. Some of these have led a younger generation in the truth right back to the confusion from which they themselves escaped years ago. Not right. Seeds of error planted in their minds back there were never repudiated. But one thing is certain, when the regathering began about 1930, the brethren were agreed on one thing. And what was that? It was that the harvest work was terminated prematurely by the society. And most repudiated it for the rank error that it was. Those who didn't have no forum in which to air their views, because the brethren were too busy and happy in the Lord's work to pay any attention. One of the authors of the Finnish Mystery, the spurious seventh volume, was Rutherford's counselor for a time on the interpretation of Brother Russell's 1914 to 1916 writings. This is the man who terminated the harvest in 1918. He said it terminated in 1918. On the basis of Brother Russell having expected the final trouble in 3 years. This thought is emphasized in the 5950 article with reference to smiting Jordan. In 1916, Brother Russell saw that event as future, but expected it in the near future. A logical expectation if he thought things would wind up in 3 years. And then he said something very interesting. quote, "We don't know how long the smiting will require, possibly 3 years," which shows that Brother Russell saw it as a process and that it would take time. So we have his expectation again that things would wind up in about 3 years. He continues, and I quote, "We are not fixing the time, however, for we know of no time future applicable to us." Here Brother Russell was reflecting a caution that is not consistently followed. We better avoid all dates after 1914. The pyramid doesn't show it, nor does Brother Russell dare to try and cover it. Continue to quote, "We are merely giving our surmise." And what was that surmise? Quote, "That a great work is before us, and we cannot see how it could be accomplished in less than 3 years." There's the 3 years again, which ties what he was surmising into the closing experiences of the church. Continuing, "It will be after the smiting of Jordan, after the division of the people, not the brethren, by the message of truth, that the separation of the church into two classes will take place. Thereafter, the Elijah class, or little flock, will be clearly manifested, separate and distinct from the great company class." Now let's keep that in mind. "Thereafter, the Elijah class of the little flock will be clearly manifested, separate and distinct from the great company class." But only them. Now, if we think that has been fulfilled, then we have to be making personal judgments of which class our brethren are in. And this is fatal. The division, be it remembered, will be caused by the fiery chariot, some very severe, trying ordeal, which the elect class will promptly accept and enter into, the great company holding back from the persecution, unquote. This is in reprint 5950, an often quoted reprint and often misinterpreted. On this point, we have been told that the fiery experience with the Watchtower Society was this severe ordeal. It certainly was an ordeal, but Brother Russell is not speaking of troubles from the brethren as a separating agent. There have been fiery trials in the church from its beginning, but none of these made a separation between the little flock and the great company. Nor did the photodrama work, which some brethren believe was the smiting of Jordan. I certainly do not. I love the photodrama, but it wasn't the smiting of Jordan. Brother Russell continues on the subject, "It will be but a little later that the whirlwind, probably anarchy, will bring about the change of the Elijah class, the last members of the church." In Volume 3, under the Deliverance of the Church, chapter harmonizes with the order of procedure given here. And that takes us back to the brother's talk mentioned at the beginning. He said that the pyramid W on plane K of the chart represents the completed church. And from God's viewpoint, it is considered complete since 1881. Not glorified, but complete in number since that date when the full number of crowns were assigned. From that point onward, this status has been maintained no more, no less than 144,000 even to the present time, unquote. Now that's not a new thought. We've been hearing this interpretation for over 20 years. But it doesn't conform to our pastor's thought nor to any underlying principle. But first, let's note the position of this pyramid W on the chart. This chart was first published in the Watchtower in 1881, and up until 1914, our pastor believed that the church would be glorified either prior to or by 1914. So that explained his being there. However, when he corrected this in 1914, he certainly expected us to make the necessary adjustments in our use of the chart. Now, you've heard a lot about 1914, and that's it. On the little chart I have in my first volume, I marked this right along in that column, beyond 1914. Now, for the principle involved, Romans 14:17 reads, God calls those things not in being as though existing. This is the diglot. This shows God's purpose and foreknowledge that He alone knows the end from the beginning, and He wants to assure us that all He has planned will surely come to pass, and it will. Now, this principle cannot be carried beyond reasonable, rational limits. If so, then we could say that everything is reckoned as complete from God's viewpoint. That's an exaggeration. Why not consider the millennial work complete and project ourselves into the Jubilee of Jubilees? If this is a valid method of reasoning, it should apply to this as well, for God surely knows that it will be so. Then just where's the flaw? An example will demonstrate the principle just mentioned. Satan's binding is spoken of as complete from the time the process begins. He laid hold on that old serpent and bound him 1,000 years. There's no question in any of our minds, I'm sure, about the outcome. Satan is already judged incorrigible, and likewise the removal of the Gentile kingdoms and Babylon can be spoken of as complete once the eviction process begins. They too are already judged worthy of destruction. But the church in glory, is not represented in the scriptures as completed until it actually is. Why? Because its members are on probation. We're all on probation. Some fall out and others come in. And God never presents Himself as knowing the outcome in advance where free moral agency is involved. Because if it wasn't, then we wouldn't be free moral agents. It'd already be determined. Until the church is actually complete, there is no bride as such from God's viewpoint. Another reason I cannot agree that the full number of the elect has been maintained since 1881 is because Brother Russell simply did not think so. And that's enough for me. The great siftings from 1909 onward created more vacancies, apparently, than new candidates could possibly fill. And this was our pastor's observation in March 1914. Quote, "We have every evidence at present to believe that the number of the elect is not yet completed because of many crowns having been forfeited. We see coming in day by day some who give evidence of the Lord's acceptance, but the time undoubtedly will come in the near future when the number of the elect will be complete. Then only such vacancies as might still occur by those falling out would remain." Now, here's his reasoning. The evidence that there are still quite a number of vacancies in the elect number is that people are coming into present truth and consecrating directly from the world. This would seem to indicate that there are not at present a sufficient number fully consecrated to complete the 144,000. If there were, these would be given the preference over those not consecrated. Reprint 54:11. How clear is his reasoning? And this article is entitled Consecration as Related to Present Day Conditions. And that's a good title for our consideration today, in view of the great falling away since 1914. Then add to that the fact that the harvest work was terminated from 1918 until its revival in 1930. Perhaps more would have been falling out than coming in. Consider also that in the past 2 years alone, there have been over 100 who have been immersed after being drawn to the truth, and the great majority show signs of consecration and spirit begettal. By their fruits you shall know them, and we do, regardless of age. Now, I'm not going to take the position that some brethren have taken and still hold that they're surely, quote, that these surely couldn't be coming into the body at this late date, 11th hour. They must be in a class that will receive an earthly reward. So they think. And I have personally known brethren who held this view for over 40 years. I think we recognize, brethren, that this is a dangerous attitude, much too close to that taken by the society in 1918. After being told that the harvest had ended, the brethren back there were asking, why is it then, if the harvest ended last spring, that is April 1918, that since that time, numbers are consecrating themselves and giving every evidence of appreciating the truth and the privileges of sacrifice? That's all we can do. Give evidence of the truth and sacrifice. Now, that was a good question they asked, but it got the wrong answer. They were told that this is the second part of the harvest, gathering the Greek company, making modern worthies, and calling fire down from heaven on Babylon. The persistent idea that these consecrated in comparably recent times aren't of the body is a carryover of the modern worthy idea. And if we are holding such a thought, we are being influenced by the teaching of wolves in sheep's clothing. And when they go far enough, they're wolves in wolves' clothing. A As long as some are still embracing the truth, as long as some are making a consecration to the Lord, it means that the harvest work is not ended. The Lord's people have been going through an era of severe trial, and after so many years of testing, it's not surprising that some are coming to the truth to take the places of whom? The unfaithful. Sorry, they're taking the places of the unfaithful. I'm sorry for them, that is. The unfaithful. And because of this, we think it would be surprising if such were not the case. These wrong ideas were spawned by the society in the first few years after our pastor's death. They stem indirectly from the finished mystery, the so-called seventh volume. And this is a surprising thing to me, dear brethren, that some are getting interested in that spurious volume again. But all these things are documented on the pages of the Watchtower, and for a time the two authors of the book influenced the society's doctrinal direction. That alone ought to stop any considering the seventh volume. But, sorry to say, their erroneous conclusions persist to our day. And in what way do they? They have been retained by brethren who stayed in this polluted condition until they left or were forced to leave. After the major exodus from the society, differences were submerged for a while. The brethren were in general agreement that there was a work to do, and so they got busy. Thank the Lord. But now the same errors are resurfacing. And this points up what Professor Fisher's observation, why it is so important. He was a 19th century historian. Quote, "Events do not spring into being disjoined from antecedents leading to them. They are perceived to be the natural issues of the times they have gone before." The times that have gone before. Now this is on page 50 of the fourth volume. So part of our problem today is that the harvest was terminated by the calendar instead of waiting on the Lord to stop his work in his due time. A reference from the December 1918 Watchtower illustrates the point. Quote, "It is probable that the harvest, in the sense that no more will be spirit begotten, ended in the spring of 1918, except as some fall out and others take their places. We remind our readers that the Lord has used the truth in a variety of works. First, to gather the wheat. Second, to bind the tares. Third, to gather the clusters of the vine of the earth. And fourth, to smite Jordan." Now hear their conclusion to all of this. "All this work, we believe, is an accomplished fact." Unquote. Is that so? Is that so? Nothing of the sort. This tells us that spirit begettal ended except for replacements 58 years ago. Brother Russell said this would end when the door is closed and not before. The vine of the earth was harvested 58 years ago. The smiting of Jordan was accomplished 58 years ago. Now, if we were foolish enough to accept these conclusions, then we'll have to be consistent and say the church is complete and actually glorified and the door is shut. And none of us with a ray of hope would believe that. But that is exactly what they did say, and at least they were consistent in their error. Now, from May 1919 Watchtower. "40 years and had its beginning in 1878. Thereafter, messengers under the chief reaper went forth with the sickle of truth to gather the saints who had made a covenant by sacrifice. That 40-year harvest did end in the spring of 1918. We believe it is now an accomplished fact that all such are duly sealed and the door is closed." Unquote. Isn't that sad, friends? Now, when did our pastor say the harvest work would be over? Let's go to the classic, Volume 3, page 232. "God will permit the stopping of the work as soon as all the elect are sealed." Was that in 1918? No, that is end quotes. Now, was that in 1918? If the sealing is complete, then the harvest is over, the door is closed, and a closed door means a final end. And we are on the wrong side of the door. That's the way it would be, and you can't have the door closed and still open to admit yourself and your friends or relatives. Now, has the night come in which no man can work? John 9:4? Certainly not. Let's consider the facts. Through all the pangs of trouble the brethren have had, and they have been pained, including a Second World War, trouble in the church, a little of Babylon getting in the church, a little water getting into the ship, are, in spite of all that, our work for the Lord has never stopped. I'll agree that brethren in some lands were stopped temporarily, but they are working again in many countries. So the work still continues. Now, these points we have reviewed from the Watchtower 1918 and 19 sound very close to some of the teachings among us today. These interpretations, brethren, were those of wolves in sheep's clothing, selfish as could be, spiritually proud, and they fully demonstrated their true character. By their works ye shall know them. And so we found out. If we are holding any of these views, God forbid, let's rid our minds of such errors and not allow our expectations to weigh anything against the facts. By ignoring how the 1916 forwards, those very important pages, affect the harvest, the idea of a 40-year harvest has prevailed with many, even though the pastor himself set those aside. It showed that the harvest is not affected by the parallels, that it went grandly on, the harvest went grandly on, in spite of the parallel dates. Quote, "These cannot include anything belonging to the new dispensation. Then, lest we fail to get the point," he says, our pastor says, "the harvest belongs to the new dispensation, and is no part of the old." Unquote. That is, it is not in the gospel age that's ended, and is no part of the nominal church going to destruction. After the regathering of the brethren, the forwards could have clarified these things very well. But for some reason, they were ignored. And And today, there's no excuse for that. But there's still not paid enough attention to. In fact, some of the brethren who never had the later edition of the volumes knew nothing about these forwards. Many who had the information failed to read it, or weren't able to receive it, so they didn't get the benefit or the message at all. This shows that these things need to be pointed out because we still have not received the help of the forwards and the help that they contain. Now, my attention was first called to them by Brother Cliff Hewitt, the late Brother Cliff Hewitt of the Pickaway Ecclesia, in about 1946. They were available then in the 1940 Dawn edition of the volumes. The forewords are a blessed legacy from that servant and resolve our problems. And they should continue to solve our problems. Without them, the chronology would still be discredited. We would not have the proper perspective on the end of the Gentile times, and we would still have confusion about the rain. Sorry to say, brethren, still have not profited by these helps given on the subject of the harvest. Brother Russell's writings in 1916 are so important. By saying they are no part of the parallels, the pastor is removing the harvest from that time context as treated in the volume. Are we able to accept this? Are we able to make the necessary adjustments in the fulfillment of the harvest parallels? Some cannot make these adjustments, but then they must indulge in specious reasoning to make things end in 1914 that simply did not end there. Those who terminated the harvest in 1918 had one fact before them, and they should have heeded it. Numbers were consecrating and giving evidence of appreciating the truth and the privilege of sacrifice. This is still the strongest evidence we have that the harvest goes, quote, grandly on. But only a mind bent on proving a theory of its own could so misapply the logical reasoning of that servant on this subject as those false teachers did back there in 1918. These matters, brethren, still demand our most honest and open-minded consideration and study. We saw where forced fulfillment, and this is going on in some minds today, we saw where forced fulfillment of prophecy led those of the society right out of the truth. And it should stand for a warning to us for all the rest of our lives. Now, I'd like to go into the subject of Babylon, but time will permit. However, we should not limit God's power to find wheat there or anywhere. A statement in Volume 3 puts a different light on this matter of finding wheat in Babylon, on top of page 194, Volume 3. Quote, since taking their lamps and following the bridegroom represents leaving all else to follow Christ in this time of his presence, it is equivalent to leaving Babylon, where the virgins have mainly been. Unquote. Now, I believe the Lord caused Brother Russell to include those words for us right down here in 1976. Too often we get entirely too technical in our application of these things. We all know how Brother Russell applies things, first in a broad general way, and at another time in a very limited, restricted sense. Now, are we going to say that the one is right and the other is wrong, trying to pit Brother Russell against himself? This is a spiritual crime. Of course we're not going to do that. And I think these should be studied. His last words, the harvest, closing the door, etc. I think these things should be studied for balance in our reasoning on the truth and adhere to the facts. And it's a pity where we think it can only be seen the way we see it when influence newcomers by our limited point of view. I sincerely hope that all of us will look with greater care into the things we are passing on to others. For the Lord said in Matthew 18:6, "Whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea." Now the word offend here means to stumble, entrap, injure, or hurt spiritually. And all we can say and pray is that the Lord keep us back from such presumptuous sins. Now, brethren, if we cannot harmonize every word to our schedule or way of thinking, let's not be alarmed, and let's not force interpretations to fit our mold. The missing pieces to complete our picture are hidden in our inability to know all that the Lord is doing. Let's just be humble enough to say, His ways and His thinking is higher than ours, as the heavens are above the earth. And the Lord intends it to be so. And why does He intend it to be so? Because the church in the flesh is still being tested. We all know that. And a fiery test it is. So let's wait on the Lord, because we well recognize that after having done God's will, we are sorely in need of patience. Peter was right. In the Lord's time, He'll reveal all the things that are troubling us. Now, isn't that a consolation in itself, friends? We just have to be patient. And not like the world interprets patience at a traffic light. In His due time, He'll reveal all the things that are troubling us. But there's the condition. And friends, let's always keep this in mind if we get nothing out of this talk but this. The Lord will reveal it in His due time for us when He considers us worthy and able to receive it. That's the condition. It's not easy, but it's glorious. So may the Lord enable us and bless us accordingly. As we endeavor to profit by the lessons of the past and avoid making them in the future only in a little different form.
Thank you, Brother Al, for presenting your thoughts to us. We keep in mind, brethren, that these things are difficult and they require a lot of personal study. Our heads are all shaped differently, and these things are going to appear differently to different minds. But if we wait upon the Lord, He'll direct the issue. They are prophetic matters, many of them, and so it behooves us to grant our Christian liberty, the Christian liberty to each and every one, to try to understand them as they see best. All right, Brother Al has asked that we close with hymn number 114. Hymn number 114. And we'll rise on the last verse, and we'll ask Brother Al to dismiss us. We'll have a half-hour intermission. Again, we remind you, anyone who is staying over, who needs accommodations for this evening, please see Gary Norris, Brother Gary Norris, as soon as possible. Number 114.
Our loving Heavenly Father, Thou who art all compassion, love and truth and light, we come to Thee, desire to thank Thee for the way that Thou hast blessed us, both spiritually and temporally, that Thou hast cared for us as a hen cares for her chicks. We thank Thee for this convention and the loving hearts that have prepared it, and we ask Thy continued blessing throughout, that we may be edified as members of the body of Christ, because all else is insignificant and not to be considered. That we may grow in grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ the righteous. By Thy grace, and through His example, and the help of that faithful and wise servant, we are better enabled to dwell in the holy of the tabernacle, and if faithful, to receive the rewards represented in the Most Holy in Thy due time and at Thy hand. Help us when we are groping, but nevertheless to see Thy guiding hand and follow in the footsteps of our Lord and Head, head over the church in all things. We ask forgiveness of our shortcomings and Thy continued blessing on all the hearts, the consecrated hearts and homes represented here.